Blog Talk Radio.
Desperate quest for perfection. This beauty in a miracle, bringing a surgical extreme. Time to see differently and change direction. It's up to me to block it out. It's up to me.
Well, good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I hope wherever you're listening from, you're warm and dry and have some time to sit down with a warm cup of tea and listen to our wonderful guest tonight, Dr. David Hillman, author of The Chemical Muse, during our ongoing For Mothers and Way Shower series. You won't want to miss this interview. We're going to be talking about women, specifically how it is that modern feminism, paganism, and women's studies have worked to promote a patriarchal agenda, and how our understanding of women in Western history is very much the opposite of what the evidence demonstrates. David's going to be introducing us to real women and what they did for democracy, science, and humanism long before Jesus or any feminist walked the earth. And I'm sure David will pull a few other things out of his very tall hat. And I'm hoping he'll comment on Aphrodite, who I'd like to honor tonight because Valentine's Day is right around the corner. And in keeping with David's theme of revealing hidden truths and rethinking what we thought we knew about things, in Aphrodite's honor, I'm going to suggest to you that Aphrodite is so much more than that boudoir babe we all think of. You see, the Greek goddesses were around long before Olympian Greece and Zeus, and these aspects of the divine feminine most of us studied from classical Greek mythology were so much more than the shadow of themselves we've come to know today. Hera was more than that petulant wife chasing after her philandering husband Zeus, and Aphrodite was a life-giving mistress of the animals, protectress, not merely a female deity overseeing the realm of beauty and love, attributes sometimes associated today as being without too much substance. So, in keeping with that idea, let me read you some short excerpts from my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, as I talk about seeing a more authentic Aphrodite through the lens of her sacred site in Cyprus. Let's see. First of all, as I said before, Aphrodite is very, very old, pre-Olympian, in fact, and many believe she was around at the beginning of creation. In actuality, she was a universal mother goddess of prehistory, probably hailing from the Near East, and is likely of a non-Indo-European origin. Her temple in Cyprus displayed a more authentic blend of Aegean and Oriental flavor. Ancient records place one of her earliest temples in Syria. And older than the Olympians, it's important to reestablish she appears on the scene long before her relationship as the daughter of Zeus in classical Greek literature. Not far from her temple in Paphos, or Aphrodite's Rock in Cyprus, where she's said to have first emerged from the foam of the sea and made her first steps onto land, her feet were said, as she touched the soil, that grass sprouted to life, invigorated by the fertile touch of the goddess Aphrodite. Visitors traveling to Cyprus today can see these three large rocks that emerge from the bay called Aphrodite's Rock. An artistic rendering of this birth is the famous painting, The Birth of Venus, created by the artist Botticelli, depicting Aphrodite's rise from a large scallop shell, which is a motif of the female genitals, a symbol for regeneration in life. It reflects a version of her birth story, where after Aphrodite arrived via her shell on the shores of Cyprus, she was greeted by the hours, who represented the agricultural seasons of the year. The hours proceeded to assist Aphrodite from the water, clothing her in heavenly garments. This tale of her birth was essential to her worshippers at the temple at Paphos, shedding light on some of the rituals occurring there and exposing a far deeper meaning of Aphrodite's role in the psyches and spirituality of her devotees. Her emergence from the waters became synonymous with the cycle of the seasons, namely the regeneration of earth, symbolized by the renewal of Aphrodite's virginity. Obviously, it wasn't impossible to regain your virginity once lost if you were a goddess, though obviously virginity of a goddess held a different meaning than for us mere mortals. The hours, as the seasons, assisted by the graces, would take part in welcoming the birth of Aphrodite as the budding maiden, a metaphor for the promise of spring, a time of new life and abundance. This creation story and emergence from the waters of Aphrodite was probably seasonally reenacted by ritually bathing and clothing a statue of Aphrodite, or perhaps Aphrodite's priestess as her earthly incarnation, signaling the promise of goddess to humankind of life, prosperity, and abundance in the coming year. A terracotta bathtub was actually found in Aphrodite's sanctuary during excavations of the building. I can go on, but I won't, because I'm sure Dr. Hillman has lots more to say about Aphrodite, and he'll tell us more about how she has been misunderstood. But first, I know he's patiently waiting, but just a couple quick things. I want to give a shout-out to the wonderful artists who so generously allow me to use their music. And this week, what you were listening to was a bit from Jenna Green, and it was her musical piece called Acceptance. And second, I want to remind listeners to please stay tuned for What's the Buzz segment at the bottom of the hour after we're finished the interview with our guest. It's when I share with you the bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week. I talk about what's happening in the world from the perspective of ideals of the sacred feminine, because you know there are many things going on out there in the world that are relevant to the divine feminine and what that spirituality actually teaches. And while goddess advocates certainly all don't think absolutely the same, there is no one big book, and we're not the Borg. There are some things that usually get us lined up on the same side, like oppression, inequality, war, exploitation, and intolerance. So if we have time tonight, because I think the conversation with David is going to be really juicy and interesting, and it might go on a little bit longer than usual, if we have time, we're going to get to a couple of these topics. First is, are we walking our talk when it comes to spirituality and politics? Or are we supporting people and platforms that would throw us and our beliefs under the bus? Also, the ugliness and fear-mongering of the loud Christian culture, namely all the homophobia that's rising to the surface more than usual because of the strong possibility Don't Ask, Don't Tell might be overturned, and the need for non-discrimination in all jobs for all people, not just the military. Let's see, we'll talk about Costa Rica elects its first woman president, and a new study that came out over this past Super Bowl week called Football Upsets. In other words, when somebody's team loses, an upset. Football upsets increase domestic violence. And finally, we'll close on a positive note. Pagan Pride Day events. We're going to show what we can accomplish when we all work together for a common goal. So after that, I'll close out the evening with announcements of wonderful events around Southern California and across the globe. So stay tuned after our guest tonight through What's the Buzz, so you're sure to be in the loop in case there's something exciting happening near you. And thanks again to those of you who have sent in email questions and articles for me to share. And if you'd like to call in and talk to me or my guest, I just want to remind you that the call-in number is 718-766-4662. 718-766-4662. And now let me turn my attention to our patiently waiting guest, wayshower, Dr. D.C.A. Hillman, or David. He's the author of The Chemical Muse, and he's called himself an irate classicist, and he also calls himself a servant of the muses. He has earned an M.S. in bacteriology and an M.A. and Ph.D. in classics from the University of Wisconsin, where, interestingly, he was asked to remove a chapter about recreational drugs from his dissertation on Roman pharmacy. He did so and published his findings with St. Martin's Press in 2008, and that's the book I mentioned, The Chemical Muse. He's currently working on a second book concerned with drugs, women, and the foundations of Western civilization, and has recently been invited to present his findings at Boston University, where classicists now recognize the reality of recreational drug use by ancient Greeks and Romans. Yay, David!
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, it's a huge privilege. It's a huge privilege, and I want you to get to your What's the Buzz, because I want to hear what's
Well, you know what? You'll stay on with me, and maybe we can even chat about that.
That would be
Well, you know, before we get into this good stuff about Aphrodite and everything we've promised, as long as, you're here with me right now, I want to tell listeners that next week you're going to be back at the bottom half of the hour, and you and I decided we thought we could have some fun reviewing and dissecting that movie that's coming out this weekend, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief.
Yes, that will be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you know, with a little bit change of pace next Wednesday, Phyllis Chesler, the author of Women's Inhumanity to Women, is going to be here at the top of the hour, and you will be back with us, and we'll have some fun with that movie.
That will be great, and having seen the previews, if I can say, I am dying to wait. I just can't wait to make some comments.
Well, you know, what I really want to hear is everything they got right and everything they got wrong.
Okay.
And you're the one to tell us.
Well.
So here, let's since, you know, we're already talking a little bit about Aphrodite. You know, I've sort of teased some of the listeners that, you know, we're going to break through this Christian lens. What did the Greeks write about Aphrodite? Who is she? And why and how did we get it all so wrong?
Yeah, you know what? Let's look at the two different Aphrodites, I'll call them. One is the Aphrodite that were presented at the university, the Christian lens Aphrodite, the one that comes through Christianity of the last 1600 years. And that's the goddess of love. That's the Cupid with the little wings and the shooting of the arrows and the falling into love and that Aphrodite. Then there's the older Aphrodite that we see before the Christian lens was applied applied, I guess, to Western culture. Before that, we see a different Aphrodite, and that's what the Aphrodite that I would like to talk about, the one that is the Aphrodite of desire. And the Aphrodite who is the primordial, as you like to emphasize, and I think you do that perfectly, she's this old primordial goddess. And when I say old, I mean she's old in antiquity, in how long she's been around, but she's always presented as this 14-year-old girl who's in this stage of life that she's coming to her union. Anyway, that's the Aphrodite that we have, the pre-Christian Aphrodite, and I think it's important to see how those two goddesses actually came about.
Okay. Now she has different sacred names or epithets, right?
Yes, exactly. And so the Greeks, when they would describe these gods, they would put words in that would actually convey the attributes or the assignments of that god. And one of the epithets of Aphrodite is she is a Philomedes. She's the lover of... Well, we really don't know how to translate the second half of that word, but sometimes it's translated as smile, and sometimes it's translated as genitalia. So the smile, and there's reasons for both, and she actually is both, and she's presented as both. So let's just keep it as Philomedes. But that Aphrodite is very different. She's very different from what the Aphrodite that's actually presented within the university system, the Aphrodite that I learned on campus. And let me just give you an example. She is, I bet your audience doesn't know that Aphrodite is actually a Medusa.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, we have to make sure we go there.
Right. And go ahead.
Well, all right. So why on the college campus we're taught one Aphrodite when in actuality, I think you're saying, there's a more authentic Aphrodite? Was she hidden from us on purpose?
You know what? Yeah, is it on purpose? Well, it's 1,600 years of cultural detritus. It's 1,600 years I like to call it a lens that builds up that allows you to see what has happened before you. And that 1,600 years is dominated by Christianity. So we begin to see things through the Christian perspective. Let me give you an example. That's the only reason we're missing her, is what I'm saying. I guess to answer your question just simply and to the point. This is the Aphrodite of the classical Greeks. That's what I'm trying to bring out. And the fact that, for example, that she is a Medusa, it's a perfect illustration of.
Well, okay, so I think probably what you're going to have to do is define Medusa. I mean, we know Medusa with the snakes in her hair and all of that. Are you talking about she's that kind of Medusa? And why don't we know this?
Yeah, right. That's what we think. Snaky hair and Medusa, right? It turns out it wasn't. Medusa was actually actually a priestess, and it has nothing to do with snakes in the hair, except coincidentally they were using snake toxins in their these priestesses in order to control, guess what, their reproductive cycles. So that's where we get the snake, and guess where they applied this? They made these salves, these crazy oils and salves, these ancient priestesses, Greek archaic priestesses, and we have the recipes still preserved in the Hippocratic corpus of these crazy oils that they would produce, that they would put, for example, in their hair, and so the connection became immediately between the power of the priestess's hair and the power of literally drawing down the moon. And you know what the moon is? That's the menstrual bleeding.
Okay, so, all right, so let me just recap what I think you're saying. Okay, and I want to remind listeners that about your credentials here. You have an MS in bacteriology. I have trouble saying that word.
No, that's okay. Bacteriology, that's fine.
Bacteriology. And I know you have the ability to translate these ancient texts yourself, so you don't have to rely on somebody else's translation. I think that's important to say. So here we're talking about these salves that they created that allowed these ancient women to control their reproductive cycles. Gee, wouldn't it be nice if we could, you know, all, you know, not have a problem doing that today or giving other people a problem for wanting to do that today. And because they're putting the salves in their hair, it's somehow taking on this snake analogy, and the snake becomes demonized, because in a sense we're talking about women's power here?
Definitely, but don't think, the only thing that was slightly off there was the analogy part. It's not analogy. They're actually snake keepers. They milk snakes, and they're using their venoms, their hemorrhagic venoms. Now, you know, there are like two major classes of venoms, snake venoms, and one of them is causes you to bleed. It's a hemorrhagic, and they were using these in conjunction with also the neuro, the ones that they were paralytics. And this is where it gets, well, let me not jump ahead. We'll talk about that if you want.
Okay, promise.
So, yes,
don't forget.
Don't think of it as an analogy. It's not. These are actually priestesses who are working with drugs. And this is where the feminists have really let us down. This is where especially scholars in women's studies have really let us down, in my opinion, is that they have never produced a picture of antiquity that comes close to the actual sophistication of what women were actually doing and how they were actually participating within society. It's incredible, because, and let me just show you that, it's with the Medusa. People have no idea what these Medusae are, and they have no. It just comes from the Greek word Medusa. Just comes from the Greek word to judge, to sit in counsel over someone, over an issue.
Well, we've lost the meaning of Medusa then too, because Medusa to us is just the evil woman who turns poor men to stone.
Yeah, right. The only problem is several of the, exactly, you're right, the Greek goddesses are actually Medusae, and they're described that way in the text. So, exactly, when you take that out, when you turn her into a creature who's just turning things to stone, which, by the way, they actually did, guess how, with their
paralytic. Through their pharmacology and drugs?
Yeah, with their paralytic drugs. I found a recipe, this is crazy, and this will be in the next book. I found a recipe, and all you classes out there who are going to steal this, go ahead. There's a crazy recipe in a gynecological text. It's not we call it that. It's one of the oldest Hippocratic documents, and it's primarily a book on pharmacology and drugs in general. And it talks about in this ancient text, it talks about using paralytics in conjunction with drugs like drugs that are sexual stimulants, things that will alter blood pressure so that a man can maintain an erection. So combining these with paralytic drugs that act on the brain in such a way to leave the person conscious but completely unable to respond.
Wow.
And that these priestesses are using this within an oracular kind of setting, and that they are Medusae. That's what... So what? Oh, and I'm sorry. How's that connection to the Medusae? We were just talking about they were judges. Well, when you need something in antiquity, again, the feminists did, you know, are way behind the ball on this one. But when you do something in antiquity, like send a you want to colonize an area, or you want to decide to go to war with your neighbor, you have to go ask the highest ranking oracle that you can find, and that's usually the Delphic oracle. You have to go ask her whether or not you can do these kind of things, whether or not the immortals will give it their sanction. And in order to do this, she has to contact the gods. And so this is the way of contact that the Greeks enshrined within this religion, within their own religion.
So maybe tell me if I'm connecting the dots wrong here, but this sounds like that's a lot of power in the hands of women.
Oh, sure it was. Yes, yes, no. It was incredible power. I mean, Jesus, the Greeks don't make a move militarily without ever consulting the Oracle at Delphi. It's ridiculous. It's the fact that people have underemphasized this is just stunning. The scholars should be reading those. And this is a great example. There's a great book out now. That just came out, I think it was 2 years ago, from Princeton. And it is, I don't have the title in front of me, and I'm going to, it's a book on Greek priestesses. And it's primarily archaeological. And what this scholar did was she looked at the material evidence left, things like questions for the oracle. What do you ask the oracle? And it turns out about a third of these, I didn't know this before she published it. Great. A third of these are actually questions about what we would call obstetrics, gynecology, or women's health in general.
So this may just be my own shortcoming, okay, because I'm, certainly, not as well-read as probably a lot of my listeners out there. But, I've always had the impression that the patriarchy wanted to take power away from women just because, they envied their ability as life givers. But this is a whole nother realm of power of women besides life givers. I mean, these women literally held life and death in their hand, but not just birthing babies. We're talking pharmacology, life and death in their hands, and also the oracles, like you're saying.
Exactly, yeah. No, I hate it when classicists or archaeologists start talking about, this goddess is a fertility goddess. By the way, they all are fertility goddesses, but they talk about fertility. Yeah, and that's what women's forte is, squatting down and having a child, and that's it. Let's leave it at that.
But that's not the whole picture, obviously.
No, there's an oracular component. There's a reason that all the oracles are women in antiquity. It's because the Greeks... Because the Greeks believed that women had a visionary capacity that men did not. They say it over and over again. And
so this is why the ancient Greek priestesses incurred the ire of the Christian patriarchs. That's why they wanted to get rid of them so badly.
Oh, historically, yes. No. It was, as a matter of fact, the Oracle at Delphi. The last Roman non-Christian emperors were consulting the oracle to find out what to do about the Christians, and the oracle said they must be stopped. That was her answer. She was politically against the Christians from the very beginning, and why was she? Because the Christians realized that the oracle, the female vision, was the linchpin of classical civilization. They realized that all of Greek religion is not about all of Greek religion is centered around a theme of the chorus.
All right, you're gonna need spoon feed us a little bit here. You're gonna need to explain that a little bit more clearly. Why was the feminine the linchpin of Greek? Did you say Greek society?
Yeah, because I'd say Greek culture. Yeah,
Greek
society,
culture,
whatever, same thing. Why was female vision the linchpin? Because for some reason they believed that these oracles had a capacity for knowledge, not knowledge, wisdom, that a male did not. And that's it was clearly discriminatory. I'm saying they discriminated between male and female vision. And the reason they did was because they worshiped nature. And that's the key, because they believed that a girl, they could take a girl, educate her in things like astronomy, geometry. By the way, you couldn't be a priestess without being a very good geometrician. Did you know that?
No.
Yes. Oh, that's part.
I thought it was just about burning incense and lighting candles.
Right. No. These women had to do things that your average Greek did not have to do. I mean, they had to be able to calculate. For goodness sakes, they had to be able to calculate movement of the heavenly bodies. They had to know exactly how everything works. They had to be able to present knowledge in a way that that reflected the divine. And they believed that women could only do that because they had been given a visionary gift through nature, and that gift was could be brought out with training and not education, but well, a lot of drugs.
and so when you say nature, and, you know, I it's probably important to make the connection that we're talking about woman as part of the natural world more than man. Is that the right context?
I'm not quite sure what you're – no, I phrase it again, Karen. I'm sorry.
So when you say, you know, the Christians were obviously anti-nature, and you know, these ancient priestesses, you know, they had the feminine voice, which was connected to nature. We have to look at the idea that women were more closely associated with nature. That's why they became demonized where men didn't.
You know, I think yes, but you have to recognize that demonization was only because it was believed that they had a capacity for knowledge that was threatening to those who were doing the demonizing.
Right, yeah.
And that's a historical fact, Karen. I'm not just spilling that out as some kind of, ism.
Anti-Christian rhetoric.
Exactly, anti-Christian rhetoric. I'm telling you, the oracles were actually a political threat to the rise of Christian power. Because the oracles, you have to see that for centuries, the oracles had guided Greece toward democracy, directly toward democracy, what ultimately became actual physical democracy, political democracy. The oracles worked, and if you look at pronouncements of oracles, they always tend toward freedom, things like free speech. Remember, these oracles had tyrants executed. The people would come to them and say, "What do we do about this tyrant?" And they would say, "Execute him."
okay.
Yeah. And that's it. Well,
and obviously the Christians coming into power, they wanted to stifle that.
Oh, definitely, because everything that the center of the sacred feminine voice in antiquity is actually a in Greek there are about six words that are distinguished as yells, cries that women participate in, and you see them in context like the Maenads have their own cry, and which has a ritualistic significance. But these cries are associated with women, and one of these cries, for example, is the cry that you once a woman has given birth to a child, what does the community around her cry? That's one of the cries that's supposed to represent the knowledge of the sacred feminine. Do you see what I'm saying?
So when you say a cry, I mean, is it like a cry of jubilation or something? Or, is it literally like a, like, we won the Super Bowl, you know? Is that what you mean by a cry, or does it have a deeper meaning?
Yeah, see, that's the difficulty, and this is where the classicists then have let us down. We all let ourselves down, but is that these words are like Olaludzo, for example, can be defined, or a lot of these words actually can be defined, several of them can be defined both ways as both cries of grief, cries of what we call lamentation or mourning,
mm-hmm.
and cries of joy. So how can one word represent both a cry of joy and a cry of grief at the same time?
I see. Okay.
But the Greeks had that concept. They had a concept of a shout that a woman could make, a voice that a woman could make, or that a community of women could make in support of a birth that would tend toward democracy and would be both a cry of weeping and joy.
It's a hard concept to sort of wrap your head around. I mean, we don't have anything like that to relate to, I don't think.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why we don't, right?
Well, you know, it, if it takes the power away from women, it got buried a long time ago, right?
Right. If Christianity is fueled by a patriarchal underpinning, or if it has a patriarchal underpinning and is fueled by patriarchy, then, yeah, it would not benefit from that sort of cultural knowledge.
All right, so you were about to explain how the chorus fits into all of this, or is the chorus just the people that utter these different cries?
You know what? The chorus is always what is a chorus? Yeah, exactly. It always comes back to these cults. Dionysus is the most familiar, so that's the one maybe your audience will most readily be able to relate to. But cults like Dionysus or cults of Aphrodite, cults of Apollo, these are cults that are centered around the idea that Aphrodite is a dancer. If you look in the text of Hesiod, you'll see that she's the dancer. She's the one who starts she participates in the chorus, excuse me, like Artemis. Artemis begins the chorus. That's her title. She's the guardian who begins the chorus. She lifts up the voice, literally, of the sacred feminine, right? These are choruses of young priestesses who are being trained in all of these crazy things that I told you they're being trained in.
Well, you said astronomy, geometry. What are the other things they had to have training in?
They had to be literate. They had to be able to produce poetry. They had to be able to compose poetry on the spot. They had to be able to sing. They had to be able to dance. They had to be able to perform astronomical calculations, geometric calculations, and they had to be trained in music. They had to understand the basics of music and how to compose, for example.
Well, and you said pharmacology too, right?
Oh, yes. But then in addition, not only the oracles, but all the priestesses of the cults, they all have some group of drugs associated with their cult, and that's something I'm actually proposing in the book that's new, that I think there's enough evidence to convince the classicists, just like I think there was about the drugs, that there are individual drugs associated with different cults, and like Aphrodite has her own, and we talked about the rose earlier. Why is the...
Oh, no, we didn't get to the rose yet.
Okay, should we go to roses?
I think I interrupted you so many times. If you needed to go somewhere else before we go to the rose, go ahead and finish your thought. But if you're done with the chorus and Aphrodite as a Medusa, then let's go ahead and go to the rose.
Sure. One last thing let me add about the chorus. This is so valuable and so important because the voice of the sacred feminine is the voice of the muse. The Greeks understood one thing. Inspiration. So you have Greek inspiration, and you have, say, a good example, Christian inspiration. There's basically the Holy Spirit is a rendering of this concept of Greek inspiration. There's only one major difference, and that is that the Holy Spirit is there the man ghost, they call him. The man ghost is there to teach you the truth, right? Whereas the muses, the chorus or the muses of Greek religion, guess what they're saying is, we know how to lie, and we know how to tell the truth when we want to.
Okay. They sound like savvy young girls.
Well, that's what Philomedes, that's Aphrodite, right? What is one of her areas of her disposition? What is her divine right? What is it? What is one of her areas? Deceit.
Okay.
Right. That flower has to be able to attract that bee, right? It has to send out that chemical to get that bee, right? To draw it and attract it. The Greeks worship nature. They love this kind of stuff. And so they took the immortal. They took that attraction, that thing that's immortal, and described it as Aphrodite. And that's how she comes out. It's beautiful. I think the one thing, I wanted to add one thing. I like to say this, Karen, you've heard me say it before. I think it puts things in perspective. The Greeks had such a profound respect for nature around them that they only enshrined or worshipped things that were things that they believed were, would last beyond this existence. So I like to say we all know that the Andromeda galaxy out there is hurling towards the Milky Way galaxy, and will collide with us in about 2.5 billion years, I think, or maybe it's longer now. I don't remember what the calculations were, but about 2.5 billion years. And what will happen is both galaxies will be destroyed completely, right? I mean, there will be no evidence of Jesus, Buddha, or Muhammad,
right,
or anybody anymore. What will be left will be the creation of a larger galaxy. The astronomers say this happens. The larger galaxy then will spin off, you know, with it, systems within itself and planets, and they'll be seeded by the right chemicals, and these chemicals will eventually evolve into somebody who picks up a reed and blows into it and makes music. And that is what is immortal.
That's interesting. That is really interesting. So it's those are the things that never die.
Right, right. And that's these words for God, and that actually brings us back to Aphrodite. She's given the name of a god. I mean, she's actually given a masculine ending.
And why is that? Why can she be called God?
Yeah.
Why is that? That she can be called God, but gods aren't called goddess.
Right. Several female, or what we call female, I hate to use this, but several female deities are actually called Theos. They're actually called God. They're not given the feminine. They're not Theos. They're actually Theos. But the male gods, no, they never go female. And I think that's something, again, that if you understand the nature of Greek religion and its veneration of the natural world, then I think that makes a little bit more sense. It's the same reason Tiresias, it's kind of a mystery. I'll present it this way. Why did Tiresias, you know, he had to be both male and female, right? He's the seer. He's the divine seer, right? So he had to be female. He's a problem. He's got a problem because he's a male. Right.
Is he transgendered or something?
Well, you know, you could look at it that way. They said he was transformed into both, right? So he was able to, you know, live both male and female and have that perspective, right? So he was the one who was insightful. So the whole idea of a male gaining female perspective and gaining female wisdom is important. And the funny thing is you don't really...
It's more about wholeness, or are we talking about wholeness, incorporate what we're talking about today, you know, trying to embrace, you know, for balance, the masculine and the feminine within ourselves? Is it sort of the same thing?
You know, yeah, you say balance, and yeah, that's definitely, you know, anybody who studied Greek religion would tell you, or Greek history would tell you, yeah, that balance is a huge part. It's part of the Delphic Oracle and whatnot. Yeah.
So what are the other goddesses that can be called God? I didn't plan to ask you that, but do you know off the top of your head?
You know what? I think one of them was Artemis. You can't quote me. I'll look it up specifically, but I think one of them was Artemis, Athena. It's Artemis, Athena, and I believe Hera, but I'm not sure about Hera. Hera, I'm not sure about.
Okay. Well, I need to go back to this deceit thing with Aphrodite, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Deceit, the idea of deceit in our culture, you know, it has a negative connotation, obviously. But I'm wondering, was it intended that way back then, or could they have meant cunning and savvy? Because you know what I'm thinking about, David, and you're not going to embarrass me if I'm totally wrong. I'm thinking about how Isis tricked her father and stole the words of power. You know, in a way, I always thought that didn't make her look like a very nice lady, you know? But could it be this idea that... all of us, or goddesses, or, you know, sometimes we need to have this savvy and this cunning because, you know, life is ugly and sometimes we need that to survive.
Yeah, definitely. That's something you said about Isis. It's funny, I think the same thing about Aphrodite because you see that with her. She's sometimes presented in such a cold, callous way, like she kills Hippolytus, you know, this guy who is, you know, sworn servant of Artemis and whatnot, and just, you know, he insulted her, basically, and so she had him killed. And it doesn't matter to her. She says it doesn't matter that a woman had to die in addition. You know, Phaedra had to die in addition in order to take down Hippolytus. So a woman was used to take down a man via seduction or attempted seduction, which,
okay,
is a kind of, which is a kind of deceit.
Right.
And Athena and Aphrodite basically says, I don't care, because ultimately humans have to learn that you don't cross immortals.
Hmm. Interesting.
And that's something, that's the Christian lens again, Karen. That's something I think your audience needs to hear, that, that again, feminists and classical scholars and historians, they don't bring this, women's studies, they don't bring this to the forefront.
All right, so say it again, because I'm not sure if I got that point.
There's a Christian, again, we have to shatter the Christian lens. The Christian, the Olympian gods, the Greek gods don't care about you.
Okay.
They don't need to love you. They don't need anything but your veneration. They're always presented. That's the only reason they spare humans anyway.
Is that the Christian lens, or is that the pre-Christian lens?
That's how the Greeks looked at their own gods. The Greeks looked at their gods as looking down on humans. As a matter of fact, Aphrodite, it's an embarrassment to her that she's actually made to be. To have to be with an immortal, with a mortal man. She's tricked so that by her very powers and has to lie with a mortal man. She doesn't like that. It's a punishment to her. It's a shame to her that she has to be with a mortal. There's no loving of, the whole idea of love is so, again, the Christian lens. There's no word for homosexuality in ancient Greek. There's no word for it. When we talk about virginity, there's a book on virginity right now by Sissa, I think it is, and there are some great parts about it, but the majority of it considers the idea of virginity through the Christian lens, and you just don't see that in the Greek. And these priestesses are often presented as virgins. They're not virgins. They're anything but virgins. Do you know what the Greek physicians said about virginity?
What?
Or what we call virginity? They said a girl who doesn't start copulating after the age of about 14, that girl is not about 14, actually. Serena said it is 14. That girl, he said, develops problems, psychological, implied psychological problems.
Now, was that just coming from a male who wanted to have a young girl, or is there some other reason for it?
No, because 14 years old wasn't considered young in antiquity. As soon as a girl was able to reproduce, she was considered to be a Parthenos and to be part of a class of women, not what we would consider adults. So girls were given huge responsibility. You know, we would never give a 14-year-old today the same responsibilities that they used to give them, the people who invented democracy. They put a lot more stock in this age of women. That's just, you know, the way it is. And the biology, you know, drove that.
Okay.
By the age of 16, a girl could have, you know, a girl already had several children in antiquity and was, you know, running an oikos, a home.
Wow. Well, okay, you know, believe it or not, you know, we have talked more than an hour already. I can hardly believe it, and we haven't even made it through most of the questions. I'm going to have you come back and do a part two, David.
Oh, I would love to.
Okay. Well, I'll take that as a promise. All right, so let's move on to the rose. What's the rose? I think that has some association with Aphrodite, too.
Sure. You know what? It's associated with – it's one of the most commonly used plants in medicine in antiquity. Rose oil is you know, a pretty standard commodity. It's about as frequent in the text as opiates, you know, as opium. Latex is. So there's a lot of, it's used in medicine, it's used particularly in women's medicine quite frequently, and it's also used of Aphrodite's rites. And what I'm going to argue in the next book is that it was a part of a compound remedy. It's the oil that essentially, biochemically, it's the oil that becomes mixing agent. You know, you can mix chemicals or plants. You can grind them up in different solutions. If you want to extract certain chemicals, you do it in alcohols, for example. You add it to alcohol, and the alcohol will liberate some chemical that will, from the plant, that will then act in a human in a certain way. So the alcohol is the base, let's say. Well, they used a lot of oils as bases, and one of them was this rose oil. But it's constantly being used in prescriptions that have to do with women's health, with things like directly associated with the magic of a woman's cycle and the manipulation of a woman's cycle. And I didn't know it, but there were, and probably none of your, I don't know, maybe they do. I haven't seen it argued, but there are actually names for mid-cycle, points within a woman's cycle that the Greeks believed, it looks like they believed that a woman had different potentials at different times. There were different, like, recipes for the compounds that she was taking every day. Like, you know, if she were at a point that we consider PMS, they would be chock full of painkillers.
Okay.
Opiates.
When you say that she had a different potential at different times during the month, you mean different potential in terms of, like, abilities, like maybe psychic abilities or something? Is that what you mean?
If you want to call them psychic, yeah. Elevated understanding, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what we would call it, like a cosmic intuition, I don't know.
Okay. All right. So it's almost like the veil, you know, the veil was thinner or something.
Yeah, it's like they were, you know, it's like they were tinkering with physiology and pharmacology and were able to, they were able to create what they thought was an inspired individual through nature, through the application of roses, for example.
Wow.
So.
Well, you know, David, I'm wondering, okay, you said that you think because feminists and, you know, folks in women's studies didn't really delve much into the power of these women as pharmacists, and so we've missed something there. Do you think it has to do with they were fearful they were going to potentially be met with what you were met with when, you know, they didn't want to, you know, publish this chapter on drug use in your thesis, which, I mean, of course, you made lemonade out of lemons and you turned it into a book. But is it that we're, academia is that conservative that maybe that was a place that they were afraid to tread?
Yeah, it's that I wouldn't say conservative or liberal. They're so locked into the Christian perspective these women that are these sophisticated drug compounding priestesses were called by the Christians witches. And so this is, even if you look at this up, and a pharmakist is actually defined in our best source for Greek language, the Oxford dictionary lexicon, rather. If you talk about what a pharmakist is, you define it there as a witch. And that's a Christian term. That's not what that actual term is conveying. A pharmacist is just a woman who has drug knowledge. That's all. She's a woman who has expertise drug knowledge. They haven't all be very good. So it's
like, they put this negative connotation on the women who had these abilities.
Right, and then the scholars just ran with that. They do. They just pick up that baggage and carry that along, and they talk about witches. So you see papers on witches. You see, what is the phenomenon of a witch? Well, then, of course, we just blow it off as, well, it's just so much superstition and fancy, and it's a bunch of women with warts and brooms or whatever, and, you know, it really doesn't matter. But when you actually look at the cult and what they were doing, these quote-unquote witches were very powerful, impressive women doing impressive things and changing the world.
And influential, obviously. You said they were leading Greece toward democracy.
Oh, yeah. People often credit Homer. I hate this. People credit Homer for being the Western father, the father of, you know, written Greek. That's garbage. The oracles were composing poetry long before Homer ever got close to recording poetry. That's ridiculous. And we know that for a fact. We know that for a fact it was the oracle that created Socrates. It wasn't Socrates. It was the oracle. It was his reputation for being the wisest man that made people listen to him. It's ridiculous, and we don't remember that from history because we don't want to. We don't remember that classicists love to sit, especially men. Male classicists are such boneheads. They like to sit. I'm sorry, not all of them. You know, I'm just saying they can be boneheads, and they'll laugh at this because they know I'm right. They like to sit in little rooms and go over battles laboriously, and this legion and that legion, and this had so many soldiers, and this is the manipulator this and that, and boxes here and drawing and arrows, and they love that kind of stuff. And what they never get, and they talk about the significance of these great battles and more, and now they changed history and more, and it, you know, how important that was. And they don't realize that at every one of these important history-changing battles, the only reason they were there is because the oracle told them to go there and do that.
Ah.
It's ridiculous.
So her part on it is totally overlooked or conveniently forgotten.
Well, yeah. It's like why we think that men created medicine, Western medicine. They didn't. The oldest you can... And this is funny. Now, I'm going to put this out there. I'm giving away all my goodies for my next book, but I'm doing it because I like to talk to you so much because you're right on. I mean, you have an ability to understand what that inspiration is that I truly value. I think it's great.
Thank you.
You have that spirit, that classical spirit, and I love that. But I can't undervalue. The fact that we think that Hippocrates was the father of medicine, and he wasn't either. If you look at the actual pharmacology, and this is what I'm going to give away, if you look at the pharmacology, the oldest drugs that are used by in Western civilization are drugs that are used to regulate menses, drugs that are used to induce abortion. Did you know the abortifacients are the oldest drugs? And that's another reason. The very first drug war was not a war over strictly recreational drugs. It was a war over drugs used to induce abortion.
So who was warring? Was it the Christians and the pagans again, or was it before that?
Imagine squads of monks and priests, priest-leading groups of zealots through the streets destroying monuments, pillaging monuments, grabbing women, and physically, I mean, right out in public, beating them to death. Because they are what? Followers of Goddess X, who happen to be using the devil's tools to manipulate nature and create ungodliness.
David, things haven't changed that much.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, they're not that quite that obvious unless you're an abortion doctor. They'll just come in the church and shoot you. But really, when you think about it, how sad is it that it hasn't changed that much?
No, and how sad is it that our profound scholars in our universities don't credit the women who actually created medicine with what they've done?
Are you gonna like name names in this next book coming up to credit these women?
Oh yes. I'll talk about every earliest invention of every group of priestesses that I can possibly find in the text. Oh, are you kidding? That's the meat and potatoes.
Okay, cool. And also you said that there were a bunch of female poets who who made the list. So so you're going to talk about the women before Homer.
Yeah, you know what? A good example for – I just learned some of this stuff too, and that's why I feel so let down by classics in general. And I've had classics at several universities, so it's not just one university. But classics in general, I've learned – great lyric poet Pindar, that he actually competed against and lost to a woman. And I didn't even know that they could do that. I didn't know. And her name, I think it was Corinna. But I was shocked because he's considered the poet extraordinaire. And it's funny because you can read about their actual interaction. It's amazing what we've missed out on. It's amazing that Helen is the one who brings the drugs to the ceremony to sit and listen to the bard, the Homeric little bard who's going to tell his little Odyssey or Iliad. She's the one who initiates that ceremony. It's a woman doing that.
So, wait, are we talking about Helen of Troy? Is it that Helen?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. So you know, I'm sitting here listening to you thinking, you know, that phrase we always hear that, you know, women's history has been forgotten, women have been written out of history. But, you know, I don't think we understand just how much they've been written out of history. You know, the full weight of that, I don't think, we say it so casually, I guess is what I'm saying, and we don't really know the full impact of, you know, how women have been forgotten and their contributions, you know, early on. It's really, really sad, and I'm getting angry.
Oh, yes, and you should, because the effect that it has had on Western civilization, you can just follow the effect throughout time, and it's amazing to see how the voice of women actually guided the Greek ship of state toward democracy. It's incredible to know that they were able to harness that knowledge and take advantage of it. You know, it's like they were farming it or something. It's fantastic. I think it's beautiful history, and I think we should be ashamed of ourselves that we don't read these texts and find out what was actually going on. It's just amazing.
Well, you know, and if any of my sisters out there, or, you know, their hair is on fire because maybe they knew this information or they've published it somewhere and we just don't know about it, I apologize. I hope you'll email me or something, and, you know, so that I can give you credit and or have you on the show. But if that's not the case, you know, I hope some of the women's studies folks out there pick up this gauntlet, you know, and we start making, you know, these things that you're talking about, David, you know, just like we're trying to raise awareness of the sacred feminine, we really need to raise awareness about all of this as well. I mean, do you think there's some shame attached because it's about drugs, you know, and we have this, you know, this contemporary moral idea that all drugs are, you know, that drugs are evil or something?
You know, yeah, except for the ones that we take by prescription, and those generally kill your liver anyway. So,
or
no,
look
but
what
I,
happened
you know,
to Michael Jackson. You know, prescription drugs. Yeah, like those are supposed to be okay.
Right. I think it's more. It's not just drugs. I think it's nature in general. It's a cultural revolution against plants, against everything that we hold. The natural world provides for humans, whether it's sex. Christianity was really a revolution against sex. And you can trace throughout history, the history of sex is more interesting than just about anything I was taught in classics. I can tell you that much.
So that's your third book. That's your third book.
There you go. That's another one.
Well, we're going to have a show about that sometimes too. Well, you know, our time is starting to run out, and I guess I want to make sure, since we started on this Aphrodite theme, that we don't forget to talk about who are Eros and Desire and what they're doing with Aphrodite.
Yeah, don't think of love. I guess my point there was just don't think of love. We've been led to think that love is this magical union between two people of our cosmic souls have finally come together, and now we're united in oneness. That's a Christian concept. That's not a Greek concept. And the idea with the Greeks, the highest power or form or immortal is not love. And you remember, there's no god love. There's the god desire. And there's an older manifestation of desire called Himeros and another one called Eros. And when you Eros somebody, you don't want to love them. Eros.
So is it lust? Is it rape?
It's desire. It's desire, and it doesn't have to be desire for a good thing. You can desire a bad thing just as well. And I'll give you the key to so that your audience can take it home and understand it. We think Cupid is a fat baby with wings that shoots an arrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he's not. He's actually a primordial god, and he's who's one of the earliest. And he sees theogony, according. You know, he's one of these earliest. Let me put it this way. You don't need the earth and sky to have Eros, right? Eros is always going to be there. It's an attraction. You know, you can have an attraction with molecules, you know.
Right. Okay, it's more of a physical thing.
Yes, exactly. It's physical and metaphysical. It extends, it permeates everything, Eros, desire. But you have to remember, the real myth is not Eros is a fat baby. That's through the Christian lens who shoots love around.
That wasn't Hallmark?
No, exactly. Eros, there's no pacification of the audience there. They want the audience to be mad when they have these choruses where they're singing about Eros. But Eros is actually, when he shoots two arrows. He doesn't shoot one.
Okay.
One is silver-tipped and one is black-tipped. Okay? And the silver-tipped one will cause you desire. That one causes intense desire, intense Himeros, which is at one of Aphrodite's attributes. One of her dominions. We don't really have a word for what they say. They're one of her, you know,
the things she oversees.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's her Himeros there. But what the black arrow is the opposite, repulsion. That pushes away. That causes. And what Eros is famous for is for shooting one person with the silver, and the person that he's attracted to or she's attracted to shoots with the black.
Well, what a dirty little trickster.
Right.
I mean, because then it's like unrequited love. One person's obsessed and has unrequited love, and the other is being stalked.
Exactly. It's grief and joy all at the same time.
Ah. cheese them.
Yeah, it's the chorus. It's the chorus, right? It's all the same. It's all the same.
Okay. Well, you know what? It feels like to me this is very deep and multi-layered. And if you don't really know a lot about a Greek outlook and religion, it's some of these concepts are really hard to even grasp.
Definitely.
And so, all right, so, well, I think we know by now that I guess maybe I'm showing my age here, but I used to love watching Xena Warrior Princess.
Yes.
But I used to hate the blonde bimbo who played Aphrodite. I mean, I think we know that that she was not really portraying Aphrodite accurately, and Aphrodite is not just this boudoir babe anymore. But do you say that Aphrodite is not the most beautiful goddess? Why do you say that?
Well, she's not. They don't consider her the most. She's never called that. The most beautiful goddess, everybody knows, that the most beautiful goddess, if you're in the pantheon, is Hera. She's the one who's the most beautiful, the most amazingly beautiful.
And how did who determine that? And why is Aphrodite the goddess of love and beauty if Hera is the beautiful one?
Yeah, what a great question. I don't think I have an answer for that.
Well, who decided Aphrodite was the goddess of love and beauty? Where did that come from? Was that part of the Christian spin too? Did beauty just go well with love?
Aphrodite was particularly took a hard hit by the Christians, and
of her sacred prostitution temples, I bet.
Yeah. Why? And people are funny. Classicists love this. They either don't want to talk about prostitutes and Aphrodite. I think the way what they say now, what the fad is this week, is that Aphrodite was not associated with prostitution. It used to be that she was, and they go back and forth like this. Oh no prostitutes. Oh yes, prostitutes. Why do you think Aphrodite was associated with prostitutes? Who needs drugs that cause abortion more than prostitutes?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
right.
And look, and maybe I'm putting a romantic spin on this also, and please correct me, because I really do want to understand this. But again, we're not talking about prostitution then like it in today. It was different mores, for one thing. Women, there was a point in time when it was not that big a deal who your child's father was, and wasn't it through, being conjoined in intercourse with woman that man could reach the divine? I mean, it wasn't this ugly, dirty thing that we associate with prostitution today, I don't think.
Right. You have both ends. You have kind of the prostitution that you and I think of, the on the street, the business deal, that, $25 for an hour or whatever the going rate is, and you have the pimps and all that kind of stuff. That kind of prostitution is definitely there. That's definitely there. And you have the courtesan, the very expensive, kept woman, you could call her, or the kept man, kept men too. But the mores around sex are so vastly different that what we consider prostitutes is not necessarily what they consider prostitutes. I mean, we would consider things that, we would consider some of their priests as prostitutes. We would consider, anyway, that's...
Well, you know what I'm thinking about, and I would encourage any of my listeners who have access to a video store where they have that series Rome that I think showed on HBO or Showtime, they really did their homework. I didn't like how they portrayed Cleopatra. That was my only complaint. But, they really showed the, the Greek and Roman outlook on so many different things. And I will never forget when this husband and wife had just been gifted this land, part of the thing they were supposed to do was actually go out and have intercourse on the land while their family and friends watched, because that was going to ensure the fertility of the land. Can you imagine us doing that today?
Doesn't that sound beautiful, though? I mean, you could imagine the rural, kind of environment, and you're mapping out your farm, and this is somewhere that you're going to, I don't know. It sounds great to me to go around and
Well, you know, I don't get bent out of shape about it either, you know, but I can, just wearing our contemporary hat, you know, or again, you know, you mentioned homosexuality was common in the ancient world, and, you know, and now today, look at people, they're so freaked out about it, you know, and probably most of them don't even know a gay or a lesbian person, they just have these preconceived ideas about, you know, who they are and what they are, that's all warped and distorted, you know, and I think about going to Pompeii and walking into the brothels and still seeing the drawings on the walls of these, you know, guys with the big phalluses and the sexual positions, you know, as if it's the Kama Sutra or something. I mean, they just looked at sex so totally different than we do today, and again, that's probably that Christian lens brought all the shame into it, right?
Right, and the association with there has to be a birth for every time that a man ejaculates, you know, that this patriarchal ejaculation is going to produce a life. That's not how the Greeks looked at it. The Greeks were crazy, and I find stuff, you know, sexual stuff that always shocks me. As long as I've been reading it, I'm always shocked. Like, and then I realize, oh, okay, I see what's going on. It's amazing. Like, I like to shock people with this one. Anal sex was considered an alternative sexual practice to vaginal intercourse. It was considered an alternative. Something that
if you got bored with one, you did the other.
Well, exactly. Yes, it wasn't sodomy. You'll notice that's not a Greek word. It wasn't sodomy. It was, you know, and they had. Believe me, they had words for everything. So it's not. It's not like they didn't recognize that. But it's not considered, it's hard for me to say, Karen, again.
It's not against the law.
Well, they so venerated nature that penises and vaginas, you know, could go with, a penis could go with a penis or an anus or a vagina or a mouth or a vagina could go with a mouth or another vagina. You know, they didn't think of it as sexuals, a heterosexual.
They thought of it as natural.
Yes, exactly, as natural and as a learning experience. They actually considered being with the same sex to be a necessary learning experience. Now, not all of the Greeks, but most. And I think that's, you know, even the Spartans,
Well, you know, I saw this special on the Spartans, and that was quite interesting. They talked about how the boys were separated from their mother at a young age, like 7 or 8,
yeah.
And they lived with a male benefactor who part of his job was to raise him and teach him, and part of what he was taught was, was sex with a man, and in fact it made it hard when it came time for this young man whose duty it was as a Spartan to, you know, couple with a woman to create the next line of Spartan soldiers. They taught, and this was a scholar, this wasn't some crazy chauffeur sensational ratings or something. They would literally shave the heads of the women so that they looked more like young men to make them more appealing to the bridegroom on the wedding night because they were so used to being with men.
Yeah, you know what? The other thing, too, you have to consider, Karen, is these Spartans, and not only Spartans, I mean, it's even in Homer, these soldiers were fighting with each other, and they're not like our professional soldiers. These are men who are friends from a community who have known each other and who have grown up together in these academies together and have had sexual activity. And these guys are fighting with each other. And that's why people really don't get the Iliad. The Iliad is a story of two male lovers who were separated by hubris. And it's a beautiful story. And I'm not the one who said that. You can read the ancient poets like Sophocles who said that. That's what that story was about. It's Achilles and his male lover. That's what it's about. It's not. But, you know, hey, you're. To them, it was beautiful. These guys are dying with each other. What is more beautiful than that they, what we call, fall in love with each other?
Right.
And so,
well,
yeah. Go ahead.
Well, it made me think about the 300 Spartans, you know, how loyal they were to each other, you know, and, those accounts of how they would groom themselves and oil themselves. I mean, you could tell these were guys that aren't like, you know, your average You know, it's just their description, the way they described them. It came across as what we would probably call gay today.
Exactly. Just like we talked about what we'd call prostitutes weren't, we call gay, and that's exactly what the Greeks said. They are not, because it doesn't exist, because look at the here's a great example. You cannot take two American men today, strip them naked, oil them up, and make them wrestle. You cannot. No man in his right, no what we call heterosexual man, American, would ever do, even consider something like that. But that was daily life in Greece. That's how you wrestle. Wrestling is a part of schooling. It's a part of education. It's the beauty of the physical form. And, yeah, when you're wrestling a guy, you're going to get his testicles in your face because you're naked.
Well, and didn't when they went to the gym, it was that they were just naked, weren't they?
Exactly.
Well, they admired the body, the physical form too. I mean, wasn't it about that as well? I mean, there was no shame that, you know, Christianity plagues us with.
No, exactly. And that what's terrible, and I'll bring back to how the scholars have failed us, is again go back to women's studies. Who were the first athletes who were exercising like this, showing the beauty of the physical form together, exercising together? Who are they? They're not men competing in the Olympic Games. They are women, earlier women who actually founded games themselves. Women, sorry, go ahead.
Well, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was about to go, yeah, I feel like I'm in your class and I'm raising my hand. Yeah. I mean, because they had the games for Hera, right?
Exactly,
I mean,
yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's exactly it. These athletes were women, and they, guess what? These choruses and these dances and these athletes, they were naked people. I'm sorry, but that's a fact. Why? Because they looked at things through the natural lens, not through the Christian lens. The Christian lens is contrary to nature itself.
And I'm thinking, too, you know, you see these beautiful images of the goddesses on Crete, the Mycenaean goddesses, and they, you know, and the, you know, their breasts are exposed. And, you know, and you know, you see the bull jumpers and all of that. And, you know, we've lost so much.
Yeah, no, and the very fact that a man cannot look at a woman's breast without it being some kind of physical crime of
right.
some sort, that a man, two men can't, if you put two naked men oiled up and had them wrestle in a city square today, they would get arrested. They would get arrested right on the spot, and people, onlookers, would be gasping, just horrified. People used to pay to go see that, to go see competitions where famous wrestlers would wrestle. Geez, it's crazy.
You know what? You and I seriously need a time machine.
Oh, definitely.
We are living in the wrong era. I think, you know, we just appreciate the things that don't fit in to today's mores or something.
Exactly. But what's sad about that is those same people, naked wrestling people and naked priestesses creating games, those people created democracy and the scientific method. So moving away from their values is moving away from everything that Western civilization has benefited from.
Wow, it's so sad, you know. And I just look at you know, how, you know, the direction our country is going. You know, it's just, you know, more and more pent up, more and more conservative, more and more controlled. And I think loosen up, for heaven's sake, please. You know, people just want to live in these tiny, narrow little boxes. And so, okay, I don't want to go and ramble in the wrong direction, but I wanted to ask you. So this idea of eros and desire, and are we talking about also ecstasy and bliss? I mean, is that part of the, like, the side benefit of these, of the way they embraced sexuality and stuff like that? I mean, were they going in that direction as well?
Yeah, desire leads to those things. That's the ultimate object, is a perceived bliss, like you said, or ecstasy. I like that better. It's a nice Greek term. And so, yeah, that's the union with whatever the desired object is, that brings a higher knowledge. And that knowledge doesn't have to always be a good thing. It can be a higher knowledge that you can be desirous of someone that ends up being bad for you, that ends up bringing you ruin, that ends up causing you pain. And that this is actually, you guess what? You've been educated by the immortals when you get this. It doesn't matter which arrow you get shot with, dummy. The fact is that you've learned that life is not about me. That's kind of what the Greeks were pushing with their immortal concept of Eros, is Eros can destroy anybody. He's known as the limb loosener.
So it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, male or female, it doesn't matter where you come from, we're all susceptible. So it's almost like an archetypal life lesson or something.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like the universe is trying to, it's like a pattern the universe creates, reforms over and over again, this whole idea of desire, whether again it's molecules or chemical catalysts, or DNA, or a donkey chasing another, well, that's a bad example, a dog chasing another dog. Again, it's animals. Remember, Eros has power over the animal kingdom just as well as he does the human. You know, it's not just, and that's what, Karen, that's the one thing that I wish people would get. The whole idea that I said before about the gods being immortal things, that's what the Greeks were worshiping. They were taking what the universe has given us, things like desire, and they were celebrating desire. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of how the Romans deified virtues. It's sort of the same thing, like liberty, for instance, and we have Lady Libertas.
Exactly.
Because of it. So are you saying then that they took these attributes, virtues, whatever, but they also personified them in a male or a female body. So it wasn't like they were just an attribute. They actually saw them as a deity that resided in the heavens, right?
Or was it
really more of a force of nature that they just more conveniently for our monkey brains put it in a male or a female form?
It's a beautiful question you just asked, and I'll answer it with a quote from a Greek philosopher named Heraclitus, and two quotes, actually. You just used the word monkey, so did he. He said, and I actually coincidentally tattooed this on my skin so I wouldn't forget it. So I'm quoting directly from the Greek.
This is your new tattoo?
It's one of them, yeah.
Okay.
So he said, how can you take the wisdom of the cosmos and put it into the mind of a monkey?
That's
but he
so
also,
brilliant.
Yes, exactly. And he also said, he's famous for saying, criticizing that if you think that the gods ran around chasing each other with, you know, he didn't say with genitalia, but with genitalia, like you and I just talked about, and sitting on clouds, we would say, if you think that the gods sit on clouds, you're wrong. You're foolish, and none of the poets believe that. You see what I'm saying? They wrote about, they took the cosmic beauty and they encapsulated it into something that they could understand. That's what myth is, mythos.
Right.
People think mythos is, they associate mythos, myth, with the opposite of truth, because that's what Christianity for the last 1,600 years has taught us, that myth is a falsehood. The Greeks would say, hey, it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, if it's false or true. What matters is that the mythos is an expression. It's a word that expresses the beauty of the cosmos. So, and that's why the cult of the muses was so important. They were the ones who were charged with taking that mythos, that word, and giving it to humans. They're the bridge to humans. This group of women, right? This that's how they viewed it, right? This
okay.
group of women, young girls, dancing, leading a chorus with music and instruments, bringing down the wisdom of the stars and geometry so that humans could understand so that humans could take their monkey brain and figure out something, just a slight sliver of the beautiful cosmos.
If we could only expand our monkey brains so that we really could get it, maybe that's what happens, you know, when we pass on, you know, when we're in that between lives, you know, maybe that, and we just forget when we're born again, you know, maybe we actually get a taste and a glimpse of it when we leave this physical body.
Oh, that, you know, that's that, or we can try some plants and drugs.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that. We don't have long. You know, I'm just going to finish out the show with you tonight. I'm not going to, because this is just too good. I'm going to skip the rest. But so let's talk a little bit about the drugs. So they had drugs that helped them, control their bleeding, control their reproduction. Tell me about that drug that you said it was like the Medusa could actually turn somebody to stone.
Yeah, I'm looking at the paralytics that are used, the paralytic snake venom. So the venoms that are acting on the nervous system, basically they slow down the prey excessively. And if you give the right amount of neurotoxin to a human, the anesthesiologists do the same thing. If you're an anesthesiologist today and you're treating a patient, say it was from a prison, you can immediately knock that. If they get violent, you can knock them out immediately with a toxin. It's a, you know, that can be administered that will act so fast that it'll stop any violent attack. They have these. You know, the only reason I know this is my wife is an anesthesiologist. But in case of emergency, they'll use these things, these paralytics, and they give the patients extreme PTSD because, you know, you can imagine being completely paralyzed and unable to move but able to see everything around you and hear and know what was going on. But
well, there have been movies about that.
I suppose, have there?
Well, yeah. Well, and I'm also thinking about some of those, I think down in Haiti, you know, the witch doctors that were supposed to be famous for, giving drugs to people and they would be buried alive. It was something that they did to their enemies. They would be buried alive, and here's the person, they're thinking and they're aware, but their body can't move, you know, so they can't tell somebody, wait, I'm not dead, you know, when their breathing stops to the point where I guess, you know, the average person can't, you know, it's so shallow they can't recognize that they're still alive. So we're almost sort of talking about that same thing.
It's a drug that we can identify, that we can analyze in the lab, that snakes have been using for generations and for eons. And why is it that they picked the snake? Why? I'm trying to figure out all the connection with the snakes and the snake goddess. You remember the snake goddess? But you just mentioned her, I think, bare-breasted snake goddess.
Right. Yeah, and Crete.
Yes. What's all the fascination with the snake, and why is it that all of the oracular cults are associated with snakes? Why is there a python here? Why is there some snake here that somebody has to slay? And then the poison that's on the arrows is actually from the snake itself, and how does that influence the people who are using it? And why is it that we know that anthropologists know that indigenous cultures tend to do this, that they'll use poisons as recreational or sacramental substances as well as hunting devices? But anyway, you take this snake, and what happens? Well, the Greeks thought the snake is, you know, it's. Have you ever seen an old snake?
A live one?
A snake that's old. Have you ever seen an aged snake?
No, I don't think I'd know the difference.
Yeah, exactly. No, you don't see old snakes. As a matter of
fact, that's the point. Okay.
Exactly. So there's something that the snake does that's able to keep its youth.
That shedding of the skin?
Yes, exactly. It's somehow able to shed old age, this terrible thing that's been given to mortals, right? This curse to mortals. And somehow it's able to avoid this. Well, it looks like to me, and I'm going to be arguing, that they figured out that the venom, you can actually, I'm shocked at some of the pharmacology as I do this stuff, but you can actually, a lot of these snake venoms are proteins that are digested easily. So you can swallow them and they don't do anything. They get broken up. They can't, you know, they don't respond anymore. Molecularly, they're dead. So you can eat them, and over a time you can actually build up a tolerance. And but then if they're injected, if you puncture, and it enters your bloodstream, then it's active. It's not broken down, so it's active. And a lot of these poisons are designed like a spitting cobra can spit its venom. Right, because these venom is just it's basically a modified salivary secretion. So you can spit these things into somebody's eye, right? And they know to spit in the eye because that's basically an open gateway of the bloodstream.
So you're saying they would in the ancient world they would literally spit these poisons into somebody else's face?
You said that, not me. But I'm saying the snake could do that.
Okay.
The snake could do that, and they knew the snake could do that, and they knew that if you use the toxin, in the right way, physiologically, you could build up an immunity to it, just like the snake. That's why when a snake bites itself, it doesn't kill itself, right? So you can build up an immunity to turn someone to stone, which is a poison that you yourself can administer. How powerful!
David, it's
that?
The first hit woman.
But she's, yeah, and all to produce enlightenment, all to produce the rejuvenation of that snake. Isn't that something? And the Christians hated this.
Oh, I love it. You know, this is just incredible stuff. I just love talking to you, David, but we're about out of time here. So I want to remind listeners that David is going to be back with us Wednesday at the bottom of the hour, and if that movie stinks and there's not much to say about the movie, we'll continue this conversation then. Otherwise, I'll have you back on the show at the next available date you and I can work out, and we will continue this wonderful conversation.
Karen, it is such a privilege to be able to talk to you. Your audience should know that I, as somebody who considers myself a devotee of these ancient texts and somebody who's trying to preserve them and carry out and preserve their integrity, you are a breath of fresh air. I have been around scholars for years who do not have the understanding of these goddesses that you do.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I've been her priestess, whether you want to call that a metaphor or not, for quite a long time. I just have an appreciation for all of this. You know, I wish I could get that time machine and go back in the ancient world and, you know, see what it was really like. But, you know, as you say in your book, and I would encourage folks to look for your book, that's The Chemical Muse by David Hillman, you know, you really paint a picture of a really difficult life back then. You know, life was hard for folks, and all the more reason for them to be able to escape, I guess, with these recreational drugs.
Right. All the more reason for them to push towards finding that enlightenment in order to produce things like democracy and freedom. Yeah. Because when life is rough, you look for solutions through nature. That's all of us turn to nature for solutions when things get tough. And when maybe a third of your population of women is dying in childbirth, childbirth takes on a different kind of, you know, kind of today it's kind of like a right. It's like everybody, you know, you expect I'm going to have a couple of kids, and well, guess what? If you had lived 2,500 years ago, for every third kid that you had, there's a good chance you'd be dead.
Well, and you wanted to definitely, as a woman, you wanted to know that you could control bleeding and you could control pain, and so these were definitely things of necessity.
Yeah, and most importantly, that you can keep Billy Bob from getting you pregnant, because you don't want to. You want to copulate with Billy Bob because of the desire is there, but you don't want him around after that. So, you know what I mean?
Not.
So you better know the ways that nature has given you to call down the moon. That's the woman's magic, and that's, again, the Christians hated that. If it's Christianity and abortion, or people should realize that the guy, this idiot going in, he's worse than an idiot, this murderer that went in and killed this doctor, people should realize that this is the heart of the Christian dilemma. This is the heart of what Christianity has perpetrated upon Western civilization, and this is why Western civilization suffers under its yoke.
Well said. Well, David, we could go on and on, as I'm sure our listeners have probably figured out. I think this is the first time I haven't had a What's the Buzz segment, but I am glad that we had such a wonderful conversation. I'll catch up this other stuff next week. But the show is about to go off the air, so I'm going to have to say good night and thank you. And listeners, again, it's David Hillman, his book, The Chemical Muse. Please go look for it and tune in to us next Wednesday, and I will let you know when David's going to be on the show again.
Thank you, Karen. It's an honor, and please keep up the service.
I sure will. It's a pleasure, and people like you make it that much better. Thank you, David.
Thank you. That's it.